When I graduated college last May, I wasn't expecting a parade, but I also wasn't expecting silence from the man who helped bring me into this world. My biological father, Dean, hadn't shown up for any part of my life since I was 13. Not birthdays, not recitals, not even the ER visit when I shattered my femur. My stepdad, Mark, was the one who stood next to my mom through everything. So when it came time to send out graduation announcements, I told my mom I only wanted her and Mark's names on them. "I know this might start something," she said, hesitation tucked behind her eyes. "Then let it start something. He doesn't get a seat at my table just because he donated some DNA. 2 weeks later, Dean was found dead in his studio apartment in Philly. The cops called it suicide. Shot himself in the head with a .38 revolver. There was no note, just a cheap bottle of bourbon on the counter, an empty pack of Newports, and the TV still playing some infomercial on loop. When I got the call, I didn't know how to react. I didn't cry. I didn't even blink. It felt more like someone had told me a stranger had passed away. 3 days later, I got a message request on Instagram. The profile picture was a shadowy figure wearing a ski mask, the handle at Helltaker. At first, I thought it was some scam account, but the message stopped my breath mid-chest. "Your stepdad's still alive. That wasn't the deal." I read it over and over, thinking maybe it was a bad joke of some sort. But then another message came. "Your father hired me. $15,000. Full job. He backed out last minute. Weak man. I don't do refunds." I showed it to my best friend Eli, who had a minor obsession with true crime and the dark web. We both laughed it off at first, until I clicked the link the user sent next. A screenshot of an email thread between someone named DeanH92 and the same user, dated a month before graduation. The subject line, "Eliminate him." The body: "He stole my family. I want him gone. Slow if possible." There was an attachment too. Photos of Mark. One at his office, one getting gas, and one blurry image that looked like it was taken inside our house. "Dude, this is real. This is actually real." I didn't want to believe it. I kept hoping it was AI-generated crap, but there were timestamps and metadata, and I could recognize details in those photos that no stranger could have known. The mug on Mark's desk with the cracked rim, his black Chevy with the dent on the right fender. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat. My mom kept asking what was wrong, and I kept telling her that final stress was still lingering. How do you tell your mom her ex tried to have her husband killed? Eventually, I replied to the account. Just one line. "He's dead. The job's off." The reply came instantly. "That's not how this works." I blocked the account, deleted Instagram, and threw my phone into the Schuylkill River. The cops ruled Dean's death a suicide. Close case. But I needed more. I needed to know. So I drove to Philly. His apartment complex smelled like piss and bleach. The landlord let me in after I told him I was Dean's son. Said he'd always been kind of twitchy. I searched his place. Mostly junk. Unpaid bills, fast food wrappers, and bottles of Seroquel and booze. Then I found the folder under the mattress. It was labeled, "If shit hits the fan." Inside were printed emails, screenshots, and a handwritten note that chilled my bones. "I thought I wanted revenge, but I just wanted to be remembered. I paid him. Then I begged him to stop. He laughed, said death doesn't work on a refund policy. I couldn't protect anyone, not even from myself." The paper was smudged. There were tear stains, but it was his handwriting. I recognized the crooked R's from old birthday cards. I should have told the cops, but instead, I burned it all in a metal trash can behind the building. The idea of my mom ever reading those words, knowing how close Mark came to dying, it was too much. I thought that was the end. I thought I buried the truth in ashes. But 2 weeks later, Mark got into a car accident. Single vehicle. Brakes cut. He survived. Barely. Concussion. Broken collarbone. Internal bleeding. "Probably a mechanic screw up," the police said. But I knew better. My new phone having my new number buzzed that night. The voice was distorted, like someone talking through an old speaker. "You think daddy's blood gets you immunity?" "Leave us alone. I said, gripping the sink. He's dead. The contract is void.
You know what's funny? He tried to cancel. Sent me a little bonus even. Said you were a good kid. But that's not how I work. You hire me, someone dies.
The voice said. I hung up and finally did what I should have done from the start. I went to the cops. They didn't laugh. They didn't shrug. These dark web hitmen aren't always killers. Some are scammers. Some are psychos. Some actually follow through. Whoever this is, he's got resources. I had to testify. I had to relive every moment. The announcement, the email, the photos, and the car accident. The cops launched an investigation. For months, there was nothing. Then one day, they called. We found him. He wasn't in Russia or Romania like I'd imagined. He was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A 28-year-old ex-IT guy named Jasper Trent, who lived in his mom's basement. He'd run multiple accounts on dark web forums, accepting jobs, faking hits, and occasionally actually doing them. He had my name, Mark's name, my college, my mom's work schedule. All of it printed out and pinned on a wall like some true crime murder board. When they raided the place, he tried to shoot himself, but he missed. Instead, he shattered his jaw, and he'll never speak again. That's the only reason I feel safe telling the story now. You want to know the worst part? There was a list. Dozens of names. People who'd hired him, paid him, canceled last minute. People who'd ghosted him. Several of them were dead. Accidents. Suicides. Jasper didn't always kill the targets. Sometimes he killed the people who hired him. This story is loosely based and inspired from a true story which was shared by one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers. This is what they shared with me. When I finished college, my biological father heard about my graduation through one of his sisters, and he acted completely indifferent. My mom and I prepared graduation announcements, and I had specifically asked her to include my stepdad's name instead of my bio dad's. He's the one who raised me, who showed up for me time and again. When the announcements were finally sent out, they listed my mother and stepfather, leaving my biological father out entirely. Later, my bio dad saw the announcement and got extremely upset that his name wasn't mentioned, even though he'd shown little interest in the milestone in the first place. I remember the way that cap felt in my hand. New fabric, stiff with pride and stitched lies. I held it for a long time, even after they told me I wouldn't be needing it. 10 years ago, I sat across from Miss Cartwright, our guidance counselor, and listened as she told me I wasn't graduating.
You're missing one required freshman history credit.
She said it almost apologetically, like she was sorry I didn't get away with it sooner. I didn't scream or throw things. I just nodded. I walked out of that room with numb legs and lied to everyone. I told them I caught the flu, that I'd see them at the after party. Then I ghosted that night. I disappeared for the entire weekend. Then I did something. I forged the diploma. My best friend Kyle was good with computers and design, and he owed me for taking the fall for him once when we got caught with Adderall. One favor for another. He made me a perfect replica, even mocked up a transcript. We had a few beers, printed it out, and sealed my new future with a laugh and a handshake. Nobody checked. Nobody ever checks. Fast forward a few years, and I was a hotshot at Breck and Mathers, a mid-tier finance firm in Chicago, making six figures before 30. Designer suits and overpriced whiskey. The usual bullshit. Life was smooth. Last spring, I was back in my hometown for my niece's birthday. Balloon animals, microwave pizza, the works. That's when I saw him. Principal Harrow at the grocery store. Older, limping slightly. Eyes sharper than I remember.
Logan, how's the big shot finance guy?
He asked. I smiled. Better than ever. His grin didn't reach his eyes.
Yeah? Must feel nice, living a life you didn't earn.
I felt the air suck out of the aisle.
Excuse me? You heard me. I did some digging. That history class, still missing from your record.
I tried to laugh it off, but he wasn't joking. He leaned closer and whispered.
You'll do exactly what I say, or make one call to the Illinois Board of Education, one email to your firm.
That was the start of it. He kept it quiet. He didn't want to go public. Didn't want the scandal.
He just wanted control. I became his little side project. I lawn mowed every Saturday. Coffee from that one hipster place downtown. Envelopes of cash handed to him discreetly like I was paying off a damn mob boss.
"Give my wife something nice for her birthday," he'd text. "She likes turquoise."
And I'd do it. Because losing my job meant losing everything. My condo. My reputation. My life. Then, it got worse. Her name was Helen. Mid-50s. Sharp cheekbones and bored eyes. His wife. The first time I met her, she opened the door and poured us both wine at noon.
"So you're the boy who faked his way through life," she said, amused.
"I prefer the term resourceful," I replied. She laughed. It echoed off her walls, brittle and dangerous. The affair wasn't love. It was power. Raw, ugly power passed between two broken people. You see, I was great when it came to finance, but bad when it came to women. Helen was the closest I had gotten to a girl since the prom. The third time I came over to her place, she told me to look at the painting above the fireplace. There was a tiny hidden camera behind the frame.
"You're not the only liar in this house," she said, sipping her wine.
I froze. She smiled.
"Relax. Your secret's safe with me. Unless I need it."
And just like that, I was trapped again. Double blackmailed. Principal Harrow still thought he had control. Helen would text me at 2 a.m.
"You're mine now."
I stopped sleeping. Started downing multiple black coffees just to stay awake at the office. My body buzzed with exhaustion and shame. And still, every Sunday, I showed up with pastries for the Harrows like some fucked up family dog. Then Kyle called.
"Hey man, you good? I got a weird email."
"What kind of email?"
"Some anonymous account saying you're a fraud. Attached your fake diploma and said I helped."
My stomach dropped. Helen. It had to be. She was playing the long game. I went to her place that night, furious.
"What the hell are you doing?"
She was calm.
"It's leverage, in case you disappear."
"I'm not going anywhere."
"Everyone goes somewhere, Logan. You just don't know it yet."
I shoved her off. "We're done." She laughed like I was a child.
"You don't end this. I do."
I'm writing this now because I don't know what else to do. I can't go to the police. What am I supposed to say? "Hey, I forged a diploma 10 years ago and now I'm being blackmailed by my high school principal and a sociopath wife?" Yeah, that'll go over real well. I'll lose my job, my license, maybe even serve jail time. And Kyle? If they drag him into it, he'll go down too. But I also can't keep living like this. I'm a puppet with two masters. Harrow treats me like an errand boy. And Helen, she scares me in a way I can't explain. I think she gets off on the control, on knowing she's got me cornered, knowing she could end me with a single email. Last night she sent me a photo. Me, asleep in her bed. A simple message below it. "Cute when you're quiet. This isn't just blackmail. It's a game to her. And I'm the prize. So I'm here, in this moment, with no good options, no allies, and no clean exits. And I guess that's why I'm recording this. Because maybe someone out there has been through something like this. Maybe someone knows what to do when every move is a trap, and both doors out lead straight to hell. So, what would you do if you were me?" The story was inspired from the real-life incident shared by one of our Broccoli Fam subscribers named Nathan. Just a day before the ceremony, he was called into the counselor's office. That's when they dropped the bomb that he wouldn't be graduating. Apparently, he had overlooked a required class from his first year, something no one had noticed or flagged until now. His phone kept buzzing all day with invites to parties and graduation celebrations. He didn't pick up a single call. He told everyone he was down with the flu. In truth, he was just too humiliated and heartbroken to show his face. Thankfully, he didn't forge his documents in the real life.
I've worked at Turn Back Time, a dusty thrift store on the edge of town for just over 2 years now. It's not glamorous. Fluorescent lights and racks of mismatched clothing that smell like mothballs and regret. But I liked it. People came in with stories, sometimes just the talk. Mostly women. Older ones. Harmless. That Thursday felt like any other. The rain had turned the sidewalk into a slick gray mirror. And I'd been sorting a bin of mismatched electronics when I noticed her. She wasn't old. Probably early 30s. No umbrella. Wet hair. I watched her shake the water off her arms and then move quietly through the aisles like she'd been here before. She walked straight up to the counter holding something in both hands. A knife sharpener. I looked up at her and smiled, the kind of practice smile you develop in retail. "That's a knife sharpener," I said. "Used to keep blades honed. You just pull the edges through like..." She interrupted me. "I know what it's used for. I wanted to know if you know." The air shifted. I blinked, not sure if I heard her right.
Yeah, I do.
She nodded slowly, then, still looking right at me, closed her eyes. "Sharp knives are good," she said. "You're going to need one soon." And with that, she turned and walked out. I just stood there, holding the sharpener she'd left behind on the counter. I looked around, half expecting someone to pop out with a hidden camera, but the store was empty. I slipped the sharpener under the register. Later that night, I walked home faster than usual. I didn't sleep much that night. I kept replaying that moment, her wet hair clinging to her cheeks, the way she closed her eyes like she was whispering a prayer. "You're going to need one soon." It was the calm in her voice that got to me. Not rage, not unhinged madness, just certainty. The next morning at the store, I found myself checking the door every few minutes. The bell above, it usually chimed when someone walked in, but I kept thinking, what if she just appears? What if she was already inside, hiding behind a coat rack? I even checked the fitting rooms twice. I knew I sounded paranoid, but once someone says something like that to you, it's like a switch flips in your brain. On Friday, I kept the knife sharpener under the counter. Dumb, I know, like that was going to protect me from, I don't know. But it felt better than doing nothing. I even considered calling the police, but what was I supposed to say? A woman told me I'll need a knife soon and then disappeared? They'd laugh me off the line or tell me to drink some water and relax. That night, I left the store with my hoodie up and my keys ready like claws in my fist. Still no sign of her. Then Saturday came. I was rearranging a box of old Nancy Drew hardcovers near the front when I heard the door jingle. I looked up, expecting the usual crowd of retirees looking for crochet patterns. Instead, it was Caleb from the ice cream shop two stores down. He was my age, or maybe a little younger, always wearing a faded brain freeze tee and smelt faintly of waffle cones. We nodded at each other like usual, but his eyes were darting. His mouth was tight. "You good?" I asked. He nodded, but didn't move from the door. He just stood there, looking past me like he was expecting someone to be behind the register. "She came to my store," he finally said. I didn't need to ask who. He walked slowly, leaned in like he was confessing something awful. Thursday night, right before closing. She didn't buy anything. She just stood there by the dipping cabinet and didn't even blink. "What did she say?" I asked. He looked down, rubbing his arms. She pointed at the strawberry swirl tube and asked, "What's the shelf life of that one?" I told her it's fresh every 3 days, like always. And then she leaned over the counter and said, "3 days is long enough to decide if someone lives or dies." "She said that?" I asked. He nodded. Then she smiled, like kindly, and left. I didn't sleep that night. We stared at each other in silence. For a second, I felt relief. At least it just wasn't me. But that feeling didn't last long. If anything, it made it worse. This wasn't a one-off. She was doing this on purpose. That afternoon, I locked the front door for my lunch break, something I never did before. I sat on the floor behind the counter and Googled everything I could. Knife attacks, local threats, missing persons, nothing. Then I went next door to the bookstore and asked the owner, Maggie, if anything weird had happened to her lately. Her answer? Oh, you mean the cute woman in the green crop top who asked if I believed in premonitions? She laughed when she said it, but I asked more and her smile faded. She said my books wouldn't help me see what was coming. By Monday, I heard at least 4 stories. At the laundromat, she told me that the attendant, that clean clothes couldn't wash away what was already stained. At the bakery, she asked the baker if she knew the difference between flour and ashes. At the pet shop, she just stared at the dogs in the window and whispered, "They know." None of us had footage. The few stores with cameras said that the feed glitched and it was just static during the time that she was inside. No one knew her name, no license plate. No one remembered seeing her walk in or out of the direction, but just appeared. That week, the strip mall turned quiet. Customers still came in, but fewer. And the ones who did walked faster, spoke less, like they could sense something was off. On Thursday, exactly 1 week later, I opened the shop and found the knife sharpener back on the counter. Only this time, it wasn't alone. Next to it was a note, printed neatly on yellowing receipt paper. No name, no handwriting, just a typed line. The edges dull when you stop paying attention. I shut down early that day. She was never caught and she never came back. The knife sharpener, well, I keep it at home now, in a drawer wrapped in an old dish towel. Not because I need it, but because I can't bring myself to throw it out. It's like a reminder of something I still don't understand. I don't tell many people the full story. Most just laugh or nod politely. They never laugh. They just nod. And check to see if their doors are locked. This story is loosely based on an incident which was shared by one of our Brockwee Fam subscribers who works at a thrift store. This is what he told me. A few months ago, a woman walked in and picked up something. It was a blade honing tool, an older model, the kind people rarely ask about anymore. She held it out to me and said, "Do you know what this is for?" I gave her my usual rundown, the kind of explanation I've offered a dozen times. "It's for sharpening kitchen knives. Just pull the edge through like..." And she cut me off mid-sentence. I didn't ask what it is. I asked if you know how to use it. I blinked and nodded slowly. Yeah, I've used one before. She gave a tight smile, shut her eyes for a moment like she was savoring a thought, and when she opened them, she said, "Sharp blades are useful. You'll want one ready very soon." And with that, she turned and walked out. He didn't see her since, but that moment stuck with him. There was something chilling about how certain that she sounded. Not like a threat, more like a warning.
I was halfway up the driveway when the yawn hit me so hard I had to stop and blink. The sky was still streaked in burnt orange, the kind of light that made everything feel half real. It had been one of those bone-tiring days, the kind that made you question why you ever left bed. All I wanted was to sink into my sheets, not deal with Zoom's barking again. But the second I unlocked the door and stepped inside, there it was.
"Jesus, Zoom, what is it now?"
I snapped, slamming the door shut. His bark echoed down the hallway, a frantic rhythm I'd grown used to but never truly understood. I made my way up the stairs, dragging my bag and half cursing under my breath. I figured he'd spotted another squirrel from the window or gotten riled up over a shadow. Then came the pain. A sharp, searing explosion in my toe. I screamed before I even looked down. Tears sprang to my eyes and bit it. A rat trap. A goddamn rat trap. I yanked it off, nearly collapsing. And that's when I really saw the room. Traps everywhere, lined like landmines on the floor, under the window, along the walls.
"Jeff!"
I thundered, half hopping, half limping out the door and into his room. He looked up from his laptop, headphones halfway off.
Hi, Mom. Shut up! What the hell is this?
I tossed the trap onto his floor. He flinched.
I'm trying to catch whatever's driving Zoom crazy. He keeps barking at the walls. I think something's in there. So you thought it would be a good idea to turn our home into a minefield?
He gave a sheepish smile.
Well, we know they work.
I sighed, defeated, more exhausted than angry.
Clear that stupid room and walk the damn dog. He has too much energy.
I limped into my room, peeled off my shoes, and collapsed into my bed. The door clicked shut behind them. Zoom's barking trailed off as they walked down the street. Silence. Finally. I didn't mean to sleep. When I woke up, the room was dark. No sounds. Not even the distant hum of traffic. Just stillness and a sick feeling in my stomach. Then came the scream. I shot up. My room swam in darkness. I stumbled into the hallway, calling Jeff's name, but his room was empty. The lights were off. Then I heard the clattering, back from the rat trap room. Oh no, I got Jeff, I muttered. I hobbled down the hall, still limping from earlier. The door to the trap room was ajar.
My toe fell victim to your trap as well,
I began, pushing the door open. But the word stuck in my throat. A man, not Jeff. One foot caught in a trap, the other bleeding. Face pale and twisted in pain. His clothes were grimy, too fitted to be coincidence. He looked like someone who hadn't seen daylight in a while. Behind him, the wall panel was wide open. He saw me. I saw the knife. He pulled it from his pocket like it was nothing. Like this moment was always coming. I screamed. He yanked the trap off his foot and lunged. I bolted down the hall and down the stairs. Behind me was another scream. The snap of a trap. He cursed so loud it echoed through the walls.
Damn it!
In the kitchen, I turned to see him sprawled at the foot of the stairs. Another trap had clamped onto his hand. The knife had fallen. He wasn't moving. I stood there, panting, eyes bouncing between the back door and the bleeding man. Then I stepped forward. Slowly, I picked up the knife. His breathing was shallow. I thought maybe he was out cold. I walked past him and climbed the stairs again, straight to the trap room. The panel in the wall was still open. From where I stood, I could see my bedroom and the faint glow of my phone on the bed. I hesitated, then stepped forward, dodging traps. The crawl space was bigger than I expected, roomy enough to walk if you hunched a little. I looked to the left, then right. Corridors behind the drywall. A whole hidden world. Then something came behind me. Pain. The back of my head lit up with fire. I fell forward into the crawl space, knife falling from my hand. The man. He dropped the trap he'd hit me with and tried to shove me deeper inside.
You shouldn't have come up here,
he grunted. But I wasn't done. I kicked out hard, my heel landing in his bleeding toe. He shrieked. I grabbed the nearest trap and slammed it into his leg. He stumbled. I shoved with everything I had and he fell backwards into the crawl space. I slammed the panel shut and dragged a cabinet in front of it. I collapsed outside the room, breath ragged, sweat cold. Cops came in 10 minutes. Turns out Jeff, in his curiosity, had posted about Zoom barking at the walls and rat traps catching shadows. A neighbor had read it. His wife had gone missing 2 weeks ago. The man in the walls, Gregory something, had a record. Stalking, breaking and entering. A restraining order from a woman who died last year. He'd been living between the walls for weeks.
Why didn't he just rob us?
I asked the officer, still shaking.
Some people don't want your stuff, ma'am. They want your life.
They found a blanket. Food wrappers, photos, pictures of me, of Jeff, of Zoom, pictures taken from inside the house. Jeff stared at the wall, pale as chalk. I thought I heard whispers. I thought it was rats. I whispered. You were right. Just not the kind you expected. I didn't sleep that night. Or the next. I stayed up watching Zoom, who slept peacefully for the first time in weeks. They said he would have killed me. That people like him don't stop until someone stops them. They were calling me brave, a hero. But when I close my eyes, I see the knife. I feel the crack of my skull, the chill of those hidden walls. I remembered the way he moved, the way he smiled just before he lunged. Sometimes, when it's very quiet, I think I still hear something behind the walls. A scrape. A breath. But it's probably just the traps. I left most of them in place, just in case.
I worked as a janitor at this mental facility for 15 years, and I still think back to this night. Don't tell my brother this, but I peed my pants a little bit because of those women. At the time, I was working as much as I could. Over the years, I accrued some debt, so whenever my coworkers needed a shift cover, I was there for them. So when I was asked to cover someone's overnight shift on Halloween so they could go to a party, I said yes with no hesitation. The night shift was an easy gig. They really just have you there so they can call you if one of the patients makes a mess. There's no list of expectations you need to hit to make the big man happy. You walk around with your cleaning supplies and sweep up debris if you spot some. Most do this for the first few hours, then hide in a closet and play on their phone for the rest of the shift. I usually bring a book to read. If someone needs you, they call you over a walkie-talkie. I thought it would be easy money, and I'm old, so I didn't feel like I was missing out on any of the fun festivities. I was happy I gave that young man a chance to have some fun. It was a full moon that night. Before starting my shift, I gazed at it and imagined how much spookier it made the holiday for those celebrating. It was an 8-hour shift that started at midnight. I clocked in, grabbed my cart, and started my rounds. Usually, the short-term patients cause more of a fuss than the long-term ones, so I started with them to connect with nurses working that night. It's good to touch base so they know who they're calling if something happens. For the first couple of hours, I walked around the short-term wing. There wasn't much, so time passed slowly. I decided to make my way to the long-term wing. To get to the other wing, you have to walk through a hallway entirely made of windows. As I walked down the walkway, the moon glowed in the sky. I spied the closet where I planned to camp out. I stopped by to drop off my book and some food I brought from home. This was the best closet in the facility because we janitors worked together to sneak a recliner into it. Management never stuck their noses in our business as long as we maintained things, so it was a treat we gave ourselves for our hard work. Management surely wasn't going to give us anything. As I was dropping off my stuff, I heard what sounded like chanting through the vents. I didn't think much of it because that wasn't my department, unless people started throwing food around. When I stepped back into the hallway, I could no longer hear the chanting. I almost forgot I heard it. I worked my way around the long-term wing, and it was as silent as always, until I started towards the end of the wing. At the very end of the wing, there is a community room. It has a couple of whiteboards, books, tables, games, puzzles, and other things to help patients pass the time. I walked down the hallway and started to hear the hushed chanting. I peered into the rooms of the sleeping patients to see if it was any of them, but they all slept peacefully. The closer I got to the community room, the louder the chanting became. I couldn't make out the words. They weren't English. It sounded like Latin. Patients weren't allowed in the community room after 9 p.m. I wasn't sure what the protocol was if I found patients out of bed. People only ever called me on the walkie. I had no clue if I called out if someone would answer. The chanting grew louder and louder with each step. Not because I was getting closer, but the chanters were getting louder and faster. I reached the door and looked inside, and three women sat around a star drawn on the ground. I assumed they used ketchup to draw the star, because they didn't have access to much else. The women were dressed in pajamas, so I assumed they were patients. I stood outside, and I watched. Each sat crisscrossed on the floor with their hands resting on their knees, palms up. Their heads were slightly tipped back, and they chanted in perfect unison. It wasn't a short phrase either. It was long, so their ability to stay in harmony was impressive. I didn't get spooked until I saw a dead cat in the middle of their star. I didn't believe my eyes at first, because where could patients in a mental hospital get a cat in the first place? Maybe it was one of their stuffed animals. Lots of patients have stuffed animals. Except their cat looked mangy. Looking closer, I realized the star didn't look like a substance smeared on the floor. Blood flowed off the cat and formed the star. I couldn't believe it, but when I looked at the hands of the woman, they were clean. The woman continued chanting. I thought I needed to call someone and went to grab my walkie, but before I made a move or a noise, one of the ladies snapped her head in my direction. Her eyes met mine and I stumbled back, dropping the walkie-talkie. I bent down to pick it up, and as I rose, one of the other ladies stood before me. I turned to where they were sitting, and the two other women remained. My eyes returned to the woman before me. "Turn back," she said. Her breath was rancid. "I think you need to return to your room, ma'am," I said, thinking I wasn't ready to subdue a patient. "Turn back," she growled louder. I looked into her dilated pupils, and the hair on my arms stood up. The other two women were much closer now. It was so creepy how they didn't make a sound. "He saw us. He is something we need to take care of now," one of the others said. No, nothing to take care of. You know, it's my time to take a break anyway, so you ladies carry on. Don't mind me. I'll just listen and, as you said, turn back." They each stared at me as I slowly backed away. Once I was a decent distance away, I turned around and ran as fast as my cart would allow. I returned to the janitor's closet and heard their chanting again. I couldn't just sit in there, so I went to the nurse station in the long-term patient wing to tell them about the ladies pretending to be witches. "Excuse me, miss. I think I need to tell you some patients are in the community room. Looks like they're doing a ritual of some kind." The nurse looked confused. "I just did my rounds. Everyone is in the room. When did this happen?" "About 30 minutes ago." "I mean, everyone is in their rooms. What did they look like? Did you get names?" I told her what the three women looked like, and she told me they had no patients matching that description. "But I saw them. Let's check the community room together. I just heard them chanting not long ago." We walked down the silent hallway to an empty community room. No star was on the floor, no dead cat, no women chanting. To this day, I know what I saw. I didn't make it up, but I also never took a night shift again, no matter how much money I needed.